Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the John Peter McAllister Building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, Virginia, it's Phantasmo After Dark, with your host, Rob Floyd, and co-host, Phyllis Floyd. Tonight's topic, It Conquered the World. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to the old podcast here after skipping a week because of Monster Fest, which was amazing this year, by the way.
Indeed, it was. Very large.
Biggest attendance yet.
If you missed it,
you should feel real bad about yourself right now.
We had a great time.
Everybody had a great time. It was a lot of fun. And the shows we've been doing at the Narrow have been going pretty good, too. We just did Phantasm the other night.
Right.
And hopefully this episode will be out before October 20th.
It should be.
As a Flick It Fridays event, we'll be doing Evil Dead 2, which is going to be amazing at 9 p.m. at the Narrow Expanded Cinema with lots of interactive audience stuff and door prizes and cool stuff. That's going to be amazing. You got to get out to see that if you're in the area. But tonight, we're talking about that American International epic feature, Roger Corman's It Conquered the World, or the Cucumber Monster, whatever. It's been called many different vegetables over the years.
It's a very interesting monster.
You know, it's not... this movie, everybody knows about it. A lot of people have seen it. It's amazing to me the amount of people that haven't seen it, though. But a lot of people have seen bits and pieces of it because clips of it show up in a lot of other movies.
Yeah, I don't know that I've actually sat down until today and watched the entire thing all the way through. I've seen most of it in bits and pieces, but I had never watched it
and
all the way through.
I think MST3K did it many years ago, and it was a big hit on that. It's not really a bad film. I mean, it's a nice little science fiction film. The plot, it's a good story.
Yeah.
It's one that's been reused and done over quite a few times.
Yeah, lots of movies have taken one aspect of the film and made an entire movie out of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there's actually a remake of this done in 66 called Zontar, The Thing from Venus.
I have not watched that.
I haven't seen that myself. We got to track that down.
We should.
It's supposed to be just a rewrite of this story.
Really?
Yeah.
What's
and
the monster
this actually,
look like?
I don't remember. It might, if that's what I'm thinking of, it's like a big winged like vulture thing. I could be wrong. Don't hold me on that. But this came out in 56, so that was 10 years later they, you know, did a rewrite on it.
Interesting.
The plot of this, like I said, it's a good solid little story. This scientist who is regarded as crazy and weird by other people and shunned has been talking about aliens for years, and finally one contacts him. And he's convinced that the alien is going to come and save us from ourselves and do nothing but good and help mankind, which in reality, the monster, the alien is playing the scientist to help him conquer the world, hence the title.
Right. You know, I don't know that I really understand why it wants to conquer the world other than it does, because we discover that there's only nine of that particular alien left of its entire race. There's only nine of them on
and
the
our
planet Venus.
Isn't really conducive to the
right,
their living.
Right. So, it's going to come here. One of the nine is going to come here and conquer the world for no apparent reason, I guess.
They're bored.
I guess it's bored, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, right. There's only nine of them. What else is there to do
there
on Venus?
There shit to do on Venus.
Yeah, I guess so.
So why not? But, yeah, our atmosphere isn't what they're used to. So when he finally does get to Earth, he has to stay in a cave that's situated above hot springs because it's closer to which is nothing like the atmosphere.
Yeah, nothing like Venus. But apparently it's close enough for this alien.
Now, the alien itself... we'll jump right into that. Oh, God, it is hideous. It's so hideous, it's beautiful.
But he looks like he's smiling. I know it's supposed to look like he's got these big teeth and grimacing at you, but he looks so happy.
And you said grimacing. It reminds me kind of
grimace.
Of a grimace. It's this big cone, upside-down ice cream cone-shaped beast with no feet. It just has these little
it's like
claw
Sigmund.
Things.
Kinda, it's like Sigmund.
Kinda. But Sigmund had feet,
Sigmund
though.
Was later, but still.
You know, there's a remake coming out?
Of Sigmund and the Sea Monsters?
Like on, I don't know if it's on Amazon or something.
Oh my gosh.
But it's David Arquette is in it, and it's going to be, it's a series.
Huh.
Or it might be a limited run or something, but I saw a trailer for
it. Okay, I got to know.
I thought I was going to be disgusted by it.
Yeah.
But it's like, the suit looks like...
So it's a suit. It's not CGI?
Oh yeah, it's a suit.
Oh wow.
It's pretty much the same story. It's just today. And the suit looks good. I mean, it looks like they took the original suit and made it with better materials.
Wow.
It's a little smoother, a little sleeker. I'm partial to the original one, and you can hear the theme song. So I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah,
as a huge Sid and Marty Krofft fan that I am.
That's going to have to happen.
Yeah. I thought I was going to be disgusted by it, but I don't know. We'll see.
So I wonder if Sigmund was inspired by It Conquered the World.
I don't know.
The look of it. Probably not. No, but in my mind, I'm going to happily say yes.
Oh, well, Sigmund's like 3 feet tall.
I know, but it's like, just the shape.
No, this thing's a cone. Sigmund's like a tree stump.
It's a tree stump, but it's still just a thing sitting on the ground. Go with it.
Anyway,
don't ruin it for me.
This thing has no feet, no legs. It just is a cone with these little claws or teeth like sticking out or all around, ringing
like,
the bottom
like
fringe.
It's almost like pincers. Yeah
like fringe.
Well, there's two pincer arms.
Yeah, but they don't help him move along.
No, they
He's
don't.
He's pushed by technicians on wheels. That you're not supposed to see.
You don't see them.
And yeah, and he's got these huge long arms with like pincher crab claws on the end.
Right.
They look kind of cool. They don't like they belong with the rest of it.
Because they don't.
Yeah, it's a bizarre, iconic looking creature that looks just incredibly non-threatening.
Yeah, it really does.
Except when it poops out the bats, the flying bat things.
It doesn't poop them out. It gives birth to them.
Okay, it squeezes them out.
Well, you don't see any squeezing.
It can only do like a few at a time and has to wait a few days before it can self-impregnate and squeeze out a couple more. But, you know, those things, now, those, I have to say that...
They look pretty cool.
Yeah, those are kind of cool, but I have to say they were... have been ripped off a couple times.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The one Star Trek episode.
Yes.
I can't remember the name, but you remember the thing that lands on Spock's
yep.
back, you know?
Absolutely.
They look remarkably
Very
similar.
Close.
And the Minox in Empire.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, you are right.
Corman. Trendsetter. So you never know. You never know where inspiration is going to come from.
That's right.
This was Corman's 8th feature that he directed.
Yeah, you hadn't actually mentioned that he was the director.
Yeah, Corman was the director of this and one of the producers along with Arkoff and Nicholson, his cohorts in American International. And this was pretty early in his career. Like I said, this was his 8th feature that he directed. And like all Corman stuff, it's a quickie. You know, it's churned out in about 10 days, I think. And overall, though, it's you take the monster out of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty standard 50s sci-fi movie. It's a good little story. The acting's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of scenes that are kind of stiff when the two scientists are talking to each other, and it's kind of like that forced closeness for the camera, you know?
Yeah.
And they're just like saying their lines to get them out and saying what they have to. And it sounds a little awkward, the language they're using. It just knocking their lines out.
Mm-hmm.
But other times it's fine. Because, I mean, you've got the cast. We didn't even talk about that yet. Beverly Garland.
Yes.
Who is the best thing in it.
Indeed.
Acting wise. Those scenes where she blows up at the monster and, you know, she's pissed off.
Yeah.
You know, you're buying it.
That was really good, yeah.
And when she's pleading with her husband, you know, you believe the emotion there. You've got Peter Graves, Mr. Phelps from Mission Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Solid. He's solid all the way through and he's pretty much the hero of the picture. And then Lee Van Cleef, primarily known for Westerns, even before this and after this, mostly Westerns. Now, these are the three main leads, and you know, even though that each of them have done a couple of science fiction-type horror pictures, they're not known for that.
Right.
You know, they all went on to do other stuff, and like Lee Van Cleef Westerns, Peter Graves, tons of different things, Beverly Garland, tons of different things. But their other sci-fi-type stuff was kind of neat, some of the things they did. Beverly Garland, of course, Night of This Earth, she did, and Alligator People, which is one of my favorites.
I love
cheese.
Alligator People.
Quit Cheney Jr. I'm going to get you, Alligator Man. It was on the four-legged gators, too. Cheney playing the hook-armed Cajun. That's such a fun little movie. And then, Lee Van Cleef, one of my favorites. Also, I got a lot of favorites.
You do.
The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
Mm.
Small part in this movie, but the best part. He's the guy that they send. He rides the roller coaster to the top with a special bullet or something that's going to shoot a monster.
Right.
How cool is it? Lee Van Cleef riding a roller coaster and shooting a monster when he gets to the top. That's a movie in itself right there. You don't need to tell me anything else about the movie. You just tell me that scene is in the movie. I'm going to watch it. That's all I need. And, God, what does Peter Graves do? Crap. I just like blanked out on that. It'll come to me. Something obvious. his brother was the thing from another world, James mm-hmm. Arness. Mm-hmm. They were brothers. Bet you didn't know that.
I did not know that.
Bet a bunch of you out there knew that. The Thing from Another World, a much better movie than any of these we've talked about right now. Also, cast-wise in this, you've got a couple of Corman regulars. You got Jonathan Hayes, who's in a lot of Corman stuff. He was Seymour, of course, in the original Little Shop of Horrors. Mm-hmm. Shows up in other things. And then the immortal Dick Miller, who's in everything that Corman has ever done. Just about everything that Corman has ever done. I think he's still alive today. I don't know if he's working anymore, but he was showing up in stuff pretty regular not too long ago. For the most part, after he did Bucket of Blood mm-hmm. for Corman, and I think his character's name was Walter Paisley in that, he used that name in just about everything he did, every cameo
Walter
he
Paisley?
Did.
Walter Paisley?
Yeah. Huh. And I think even Clint Eastwood used that in one of his movies. Like when he's checking into a hotel, he uses that as his alias. I can't remember the movie, but I have seen the clip. A little neat thing to look out for.
That's cool.
Now, everybody out there listening has to find out what movie that was that Clint Eastwood used that alias in. If you find out, drop us a line. Send it to the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page or the Phantasmo After Dark email at phantasmoad@gmail.com. That's phantasmode@gmail.com. Because I'd really be interested in finding out, actually. This has got... I keep going back to saying it's a nice, straight-ahead little science fiction picture. Not campy really at all until you see the monster, mm-hmm. but there are a couple of glaring goof ups in it. My favorite one was the one where Peter Graves is coming into the lab and he's got the gun and he shoots. The one scientist goes to grab him and he tries to shoot him, but the gun is obviously pointed at the floor.
Yeah.
And he shoots it and it's almost like it's not even close to hitting his foot, but you would think, okay, he shot him in the foot, you know, but the gun goes, he shoots him and the guy grabs his stomach and falls down. And then he shoots the two other guys and apparently the one guy he only gets in the arm. And just like in all, you know, older movies like this, there's no blood.
No.
You know, where they got shot. They plugged it with their finger or something. I don't know. There's another bit where the car is supposed to have been, all power is stopped. Every kind of power, electrical power, whatever, stopped. He gets out of his car, and the little, like, courtesy light is still comes on.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Yeah. Oops.
Yeah, oops. Now, this isn't a goof, but this is one of my favorite things. The low budget, because they have to imply, they have to let you know where you are. The lab they go into is really kind of sparse, and it's supposed to be tracking a satellite, so it's just got a couple little... things with dials on them and yeah. buttons for
couple
them to push and
monitors.
A couple little screens. But so you'll know it's a space lab. They've got this one wall. It's got this huge poster or like section of wallpaper of the galaxy on it.
Yeah.
So you know you're in a space lab. You know? Like something would be in a kid's room.
Yes. Yeah. In case you're not sure that this yeah. is the lab, here you go. It's like you're walking into the planetarium.
Yeah. And it's this huge room. I mean, the way that they've got the camera so far back, mm-hmm. you can see it's a big room and there's not much in it.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
they
really
should
open.
Have tightened the shot up a little bit,
right.
I think.
There's not even like a bunch of desks or anything. It's just kind of one wall
there's
with
one,
some stuff.
And there's one desk way over on the yeah. other side. And there's a little counter under these monitors. And this guy's got something. It's got, I don't know if it's like an old radio or something. It's got two little reader dials on it, you know, with the arms that go measure the amount, the resistance, or whatever. But he's got a couple little dials under that and two little buttons. And then over here under the monitors, they've got some little buttons and stuff to press.
It's high tech, Rob.
Oh, it's high tech, yeah. So, I mean, you have to be a scientist to understand it.
Yes,
I didn't.
Yes, indeed.
You could easily tear this movie apart. But,
well, you could, but
you know,
why
and
would
they
you
did
want
on
to?
MST3K.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I get there's a lot of fun in tearing those apart, but
oh,
it's still
yeah.
so
and
much fun.
You take it in a context. I mean, if you can watch it in the context of when it was made and not through the jaded eyes of today,
right.
of what you're used to today.
Yeah.
It's,
and then one of
it's
the
not
first...
bad. It's not as bad as it gets credit for being.
Yeah.
It's not great by any means, but the worst part about it is the monster.
Yes, indeed.
It's so goofy looking. If that looked, probably if that looked better, it wouldn't get torn as much. Mm-hmm. There's only two other things in it that I think hamper it a little bit.
Okay.
And we talked about it earlier a little bit. A couple of scenes where they're trying to get all that dialogue out,
mm-hmm.
and it sounds kind of awkward.
Yeah.
Leaving and Cleef delivering it.
Mm-hmm.
And even Peter Graves, where they're like having to get all these little monologues out to each other. Mm-hmm. It's a little forced. But then the Jonathan Hayes and Dick Miller as the two army guys.
Oh, yeah.
They're little comic relief kind of bits, yeah. Which is just like...
Why is it even
it doesn't
there?
It doesn't even need to be there.
You know,
it's not funny, really. And
I think I discovered why they put anything in there. I mean, I don't know why they had to have it. Because once the general guy or whatever sends them off into the woods to do reconnaissance, he calls it.
Yeah.
They really didn't have to be seen again other than to maybe show them marching out there.
Yeah.
I think they just did it to show that they're out there so that when they show up at the cave.
You remember that
they're there.
It could have been. That could very well have been.
I think that's it. But it wasn't necessary.
No. No, not at all. Not at all.
No, because the comic relief was really weird. Well, one of the things that stood out to me, which is very weird and probably makes no sense to anybody or nobody really cares, but I thought it was funny that Joan drove the car. I know that's silly.
Oh, being it's like 1956. Yeah.
Normally, when I watch any of these old sci-fi movies, they always have the guy drive the car.
The man drives the car and the woman cooks the dinner.
Yes, that's how it always is. Well, this time, she is the one driving the car. They were in a giant hurry to get back to whatever the lab is, and he hops in the passenger side.
He was just too important to drive himself.
Yeah, right.
You know, he's a major scientist.
And then he goes in, and when he leaves to leave, she's just sitting in the car waiting on him.
Like a good little obedient wife.
Yeah, right. It's like, what the hell? She had to sit there the whole time. I'm just waiting.
She's his chauffeur in addition to his maid and cook.
And whatever else, right? So weird. It's very strange. Well, one of the things I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Well, apparently there's lots of things I thought were interesting. The themes that they kind of had going through the movie. Not themes so much, but the... The storylines that so many other movies have taken off of this. So
one of
them is kind of like Body Snatchers, right?
Yeah, where they basically replace the humans
only
with
a certain number of them.
Yeah, with emotionless creatures,
right?
That still look like the person, yeah.
Right? So that's one
of
the ways that they're conquering the world.
Uh-huh.
The second part of it was that they're emotionless. So to save humanity, we have to get rid of all emotions. So there are movies Equilibrium and other movies that have taken away all emotions in order to save us. What was another one? Just aliens conquering us is, of course,
the
themes that have been done over and over.
Appearing to help us.
Yes.
To start off, like, we're going to help you and we're going to, you know, take away all disease and crime and we're going to save your planet, save you from yourselves. Nah, not really.
That's not really what we're here to do. What else was there?
I don't know. You started this.
I know, but there were a bunch. I was in the shower when I thought of this.
Well, I could have brought the microphone in there.
But no, the point is that I don't know at what point in, you know, movie timeline here all these things came about, but I found it interesting that many movies have come after it that have taken just a portion and made a whole movie out of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, this one kind of brings little pieces of a lot of things that somebody else took and flushed a whole movie.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, it's like they always say, there's nothing new in Hollywood.
No, I get it.
It would be interesting to go further back though.
Yeah, and see if it's been done before.
And check out some other ones and see if it's been done.
Yeah.
This one though, being as notorious as it is,
mm-hmm.
and as well known as it is by people. Yeah, you know, I can see that happen. You know, I saw something today that I saw a long time ago talking about homages to other movies or outright stealing, if you want to call it.
Yeah.
There's a movie. Crap, I can't remember the name of it now. It's a silent film that if you take some scenes from The Shining, Stanley Kubrick, Shining, okay, with Nicholson, scene for scene, a direct ripoff of this silent film.
Really?
The woman gathering the children in the bedroom, running into the bathroom, the guy coming and hitting the bathroom with the axe, a piece of the door flaking off, him going through it and then reaching through. Yeah, it's, they show the scene side by side, and it's amazing.
Hmm. And they say, you don't remember what the movie was called?
I can't remember right now. And they said it was, you know, Kubrick's kind of homage to that silent film that he really liked a lot.
Huh, that's really cool.
Now, another interesting thing about It Conquered the World here, when it was released, especially in Europe, it got an X certificate, which meant that only adults could go see it. And a lot of horror pictures then got that. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of Hammer stuff got it when that came out in the 60s. But the reason this guy is because at the end where he uses the blowtorch in the creature's eye, it was like, they said, no, it's like cruelty to animals.
Oh, No, really.
Yeah, and the producers had to go, well, you know, it's not a real animal. It's a creature from another world.
That's
it's an
not
alien.
True. It's not real.
Yeah, even though even if it was a fake dog, it would still be cruelty to portraying cruelty to animals.
Right.
So that's
right.
What they were getting at. But they had to convince them. They said, no, it's an alien from another world. It's an alien invader. It's not like really an animal. So I think it got lifted. They got a, you know, the regular rating.
Wow.
For that.
That is pretty crazy.
Now, also in the States, this was released on double bill with She Creature, which is another interesting little film.
I don't think I've seen that. Have I?
You might have watched it with me before. It's one of those that it's a short film,
mm-hmm.
and it's an interesting idea, and it's not a bad little movie, but it's another quickie, and you kind of forget about it.
Mm, apparently.
You know, but the suit is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
The creature suit's amazing. It's one of those like this that you remember,
mm-hmm.
but it's a person in the suit, you know, walking. It's a nice-looking suit.
Mm-hmm.
Garish as hell. But really, with the antenna coming off and all the scales, it's really kind of cool. We'll have to watch it, maybe do a short podcast on that. This one's probably going to be kind of short today because it's not really a whole lot to say about this other than what we've said and give it a watch. Oh, the creature was built, the creature suit, or
uh-huh.
they conquer the world. Beulah is the nickname, what they've called
it. The creature's nickname, Beulah?
Yeah, on set, that's what they called it. Paul Blaisdell built it, but he didn't want his name in the credits for some reason.
Huh.
He also did, you know, Saucer Men, Invasion of the Saucer Men.
Right.
Did She Creature,
mm-hmm.
and numerous other creature costumes for Corman and other films in the 50s and early 60s. A master at what he did. He did, you know, some great looking stuff. Even this. The original idea for this, Corman had it, when they first built it, it was shorter and had kind of a flat, squished in head.
Mm-hmm.
Because, he was saying, well, you know, heavier gravity on Venus, you know, they would adapt to be lower to the ground. But then he realized, no, the gravity's not heavier on Venus. And it wasn't scary at all. It'd be scarier if it was taller. So that's when they had to make it taller. They made the cone shape. Also, Beverly Garland came out when she first saw it, and she said, her quote is, "That conquered the world." And she kicked it and it fell over.
Oh,
the smaller one.
The smaller one. Oh, no.
But yeah, She Creature, that one, it's the monster from the id.
Hmm.
It's a manifestation of this girl that goes under hypnosis, but it comes out of the sea. And it's that's another one. It's an interesting little quirky little picture. We'll have to maybe watch that this evening and lay down to the podcast sometime this week.
Maybe.
No promises, but we'll see. But I think you might enjoy that one because it is a different plot. But we'll see. I'll let you be the judge of that. Now, Corman went on to do, everybody knows, tons of other pictures after this. Directed, produced, wrote, appeared in, and everybody's got their favorite.
What's your favorite, Rob? You have so many.
Well, Corman stuff?
Yes.
Death Race 2000.
Of course. That's my favorite, too.
You know, that's... definitely, just off the top of my head, boom, Death Race 2000.
Yes. Speaking of Death Race 2000, I'm so disappointed in the new one.
Oh, God, that was so bloody awful.
It started out really well.
It started out like it had potential. And then about 15 minutes in, it just skipped a groove and was just crap.
That's Death Race, what, 2050? Is that what he called
it?
Yeah, Corman, and for those of you who don't know, Corman did a sequel to Death Race 2000 called Death Race 2050.
It just came out last year, right? Or maybe
earlier this year, 2017. Yeah. And it looked like it was going to be amazing, but it really fell short.
Yeah,
it
just
was so
missed
sad.
All the social political commentary the first one had. It missed the dark humor. It had some characters that like, okay, they're going to be cool. Right off the bat, the Frankenstein costume and mask looked like shit.
Yeah.
And the car didn't look near as cool as the original.
I like the guy that they had playing.
Oh, the guy is cool.
I forget his name now.
Manu Bennett.
Yeah, that's him.
Who's been in everything recently.
He's done a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
It was actually a name.
Yeah.
But it was just a misstep.
Just a bad misstep.
What a shame. You guys go watch it anyway and see what you think. I think it's
on
Netflix. Yeah, well, it's on Netflix. You can watch it if you have Netflix for free. So.
Now, the other Corman stuff, real quick. You know, the Vincent Price stuff, the Poe stuff.
Of course.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Mask of the Red Death, Tomb of Legia, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff. Watch that.
Of course.
Definitely go watch that stuff.
Yes.
You know, hey, and speaking of that, you know, like I just said, everybody's got their favorite Corman stuff. Let us know what your favorite Roger Corman film is. definitely throw us a bone on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page. Let's see if we can get a general consensus on what the overall favorite is, and you know, maybe we'll do a podcast on that one. That'd be kind of cool.
Maybe we should do a poll.
Yeah, a horn poll.
Horn poll. We're not at the drive-in.
No. Maybe I'll put a poll up on the page, and that'd be cool. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be interesting, just to know.
Yeah. Like I said earlier, this is going to be a short one. I think we've about covered it.
Yeah.
You know, the whole point, really, doing these podcasts is it's definitely not to impress you with our knowledge of these films. I'm not that pretentious, but, you know, one, it's just for us to have a good time talking about films that we really like.
Yep.
Or have left an impression on us. And two, it's maybe to expose anybody that could be listening to something they haven't seen before or curious about. And, you know, and get you to watch it. Because that's the whole thing about these films is watch them and have fun with them. And talk about them with your friends and get them to watch them.
Yes.
And keep them alive. That's the main reason we do this.
Well, we love to talk about the stuff that we enjoy and introducing it to people that have never seen it before. Or finding people who have seen it before and talking to them about it for the first time.
And have a different take on it. I love that.
It's always fun. Yeah. So when we find new people to talk to about it, it's always fun. So, yeah.
So
find us, talk
right
about
on.
It.
And hopefully we'll have, we got some ideas for a couple other podcasts. Still and try to get that three-part Frankenstein.
For a year.
I know. It's just trying to get three people who live in different parts of the country schedule to be on satellite at the same time in
the
lounge.
It'll happen eventually. Yeah. Don't hold your breath, people, but it'll happen eventually.
But we've got some other cool ideas coming up here. Hopefully we'll have a special guest before Halloween.
Yes.
And have another podcast out right before then. So
sounds good. Well, before we close up shop, you have one more thing to do.
Oh, yes. The world revolves around Planet of the Apes.
Yes. Rob?
Who do you want me to connect?
Paul Blaisdell,
the builder of Beulah, the creature in this film.
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. Paul Blaisdell built the creature in this film, built the she-creature, built Invasion of the Saucer Men, Suits. His assistant in a few of these films was Bob Burns.
Okay.
All right. Bob Burns, known for playing a gorilla suit guy and also one of the biggest collectors of horror sci-fi movie memorabilia this side of Farry Ackerman, played Tracy the Gorilla in the Saturday morning Ghostbusters live action show in the 70s, which is amazing, by the way. One of the guest stars on that show, that was a weekly show where it was a different ghost of a monster they had to hunt down.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ghosts was Dr. Jekyll.
Okay.
Played by Severin Darden.
Okay.
Who was the mutant leader in Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Well, alrighty then. That was pretty quick. Good job.
Whew. Yeah, so if I would have gone with Forrest Tucker, it would have been going the long way. That's an inside joke. But anyway. This ain't that kind of show. It is a family show.
The world does indeed revolve around Planet of the Apes.
Yes, it does. I think that's about all for this episode.
That's all I got.
All righty. Well, till next time, thanks for listening. Good night, everybody.
Good night.